I will start out by describing what the Life After 40 Project is, because it really is not about women after 40. Several years ago, the Title X program turned 40 years old. And it happened right as the health reform legislation was being debated and eventually passed. And so NIFRA began a series of conferences and meetings with its membership that were entitled Life After 40, meaning, okay, Title X, many of you programs have been around for 40 years. As a lot of us hit middle age, we ask ourselves that question, what's next in the next 40 years? And it was a very apt question to be asking of the family planning field at that point in time, because as Dana has so correctly stated in her presentation, things must change in family planning, particularly with all the changes that are happening with health reform. And as the project itself got started, as members of NIFRA began to say, okay, NIFRA, you're telling us we have to change. We don't know how to do that. We don't know what it means. We don't know what this legislation means for us. We don't quite know where to start. Many of our members, as Dana alluded to, are county health departments, state health departments, small standalone family planning centers in rural areas, or small family planning centers in urban areas. Yes, there are the Planned Parenthoods, and they get, luckily for them, a lot of support, and we work with them very closely. But we also have a lot of family planning centers that we work with who are not affiliated at all with Planned Parenthood and who don't have an infrastructure that they can look to. And while NIFRA has for many years been an advocacy agency on their behalf for Title X budgeting, for legislative and regulatory advocacy at the federal level, NIFRA did not, until this project started, have a technical assistance component. And so this project was created to help family planning projects providers throughout the country figure out technically what it means for service delivery. If you're out there in the field day to day, what has to change for you and how can you get help from your peers and other experts in how to do this? So with the family planning field, we identified a number of what we're calling viable pathways that people could explore and see if they were the right way for them to go. Because of the nature of family planning organizations, I don't know if you can read this, it's probably a little grayed out with the amount of light in the room, but the first bullet says many types of organizations provide family planning. So there can't be one model for partnerships or for how to do things. And it's that variation in the type of family planning providers that is so crucial to its core nature, part of the safety net. It is those health departments, those standalone family planning providers that are nonprofits. It's the Planned Parenthoods, it's community health centers, it's federally qualified health centers. They're all over the place. And so as we look to figure out what it can become, there are lots of different ways to approach it and lots of challenges that each of these organizations faces. One of the key points that Dana mentioned in the actual law is looking for integration of services. And so one of the kind of no-brainers that we and a lot of other people have come up with is the need to integrate family planning into primary care services. And I know that a lot of us may think that really is a no-brainer, but it's not for an awful lot of folks for a whole variety of reasons. There are many in the family planning community who have been doing this for years and feel that they are the gateway to primary care, but for a variety of reasons cannot provide the full scope of services. Many of those reasons have been reimbursement related in the past, or just funding related or mission related. And there are a lot of primary care providers who either don't do family planning for cultural or religious reasons, or who do it but don't do it in what the Title X world considers a comprehensive way. I was chatting with someone at the expo yesterday who used to be a public health nurse in a family planning center who now works at a community health center and was saying to me that one of the challenges that they face as they're trying to improve their family planning services in the community health center is providers who did what one of hers did the other day, basically say, well, the patient wants Depo, so I'm going to give her a prescription to go to the pharmacy and get her Depo and bring it back and we'll administer it. Anybody want to raise hands on how many think that patient's going to show back up at the clinic with her Depo? Yeah. So the person who I was talking to at the expo yesterday was saying to me, as a community health center, she wants within her center to improve this. It's not unified within the center that they do. They have a health department locally that would like to work with them that they currently have a referral arrangement with. So the solution for that patient was, okay, we'll send them to the health department family planning clinic. But as Dana said about her gallbladder, you can bet that the next time that patient goes back to her primary care provider, that provider's not going to know whether she got the Depo or not. So that lack of communication is just a huge barrier to the field at the moment. One of the other issues we face with a lot of the county health departments, city health departments, is that as public agencies, they have either real or perceived barriers to what they can do with other providers. Confidentiality being a huge one for many, and I know this is something Bill Smith would have talked about were he here for the HIV and STI discussion. It's even more important, but certainly within family planning, that confidentiality has been a huge issue, and still is for an awful lot of the women who seek family planning services in family planning centers and who feel that if they go to another primary care provider, they may not get the same privacy and confidentiality. One of the other things that makes it a challenge historically for family planning centers to partner and integrate with primary care has been that it is a low-tech but high-touch service, that most of the service is provided by nurses or counselors. There's heavy reliance on mid-level practitioners, nurse practitioners, PAs, and a relatively small physician involvement. And so that is something that has not led to particularly good reimbursement from either Medicaid or insurance in the past, which has made it unattractive historically for some partnership opportunities or for family planning centers themselves to grow without lots and lots of federal or state subsidy money. The other issue that they face, which is, you know, there's always, you know, the flip side to the silver lining of the cloud, maybe. Whereas Title X is a big silver lining for safety net providers, it also comes with a burden of regulation and reporting requirements and things that the people in the field deal with comfortably. But as we've talked to many, many members who try to make partnerships and not go it alone, those regulations are sometimes in conflict with FQHCs or other partners in terms of very strong, objective, non-discriminatory, non-directive counseling. You can't nudge a patient this way or that way on her pregnancy options or even on her method choice. And so a lot of these things have historically been big issues for us. However, with the ACA, we become more attractive partners. And this is something that I think is going to make a big difference in the delivery of service over time, because it goes to the heart of the financial viability of family planning, which, as Dana said, this is insurance reform in many ways, but those few nuggets that she put up in her slides really do cover some things that are critical. Coverage of that preventive exam, coverage of all of the FDA-approved methods, all of those things make it much easier for a family planning practice to sell itself, or it's not itself, but its benefits for partnership, for referral arrangements, for not going alone to other primary care providers. They're also, and this is something that's been known for ages, and again, Dana alluded to it a little bit, our family planning patients are often the first point of contact that they have with the healthcare delivery system. They may be immigrants, they may be people who've traditionally never had insurance, and so they will seek out care at a subsidized family planning center where they might not go find any other services. And as they get more insurance options open to them, the questionnaires, the surveys that we've done indicate that a lot of people's patients feel they're still going to keep coming to them because they're the trusted first point of contact. They're that indigenous community-based organization that people feel comfortable going to. That's where they're going to learn which insurance plans they can access and which might be the best ones for them, for their kids, for their husbands, for their parents. And so for a lot of primary care centers, some of whom aren't getting that infrastructure money Dana referred to, they're looking for ways to expand access to their services. And family planning providers are, in fact, a fabulous complementary partnership to do that because they do get these women walking in the door for the first time. They're also providers that can really help to improve primary care service delivery because they do family planning as a primary care service very well. They're low cost, so that makes them attractive, particularly with these new insurance provisions that will pay for counseling as well as the methods, as well as the preventive exam. They use a provider extender model, which makes them, again, low cost. They are experts in reproductive and sexual health. For anyone who has worked with primary care providers extensively, and I have for at least 3 decades, I don't think I have met more than a handful who were comfortable taking a sexual history and who probably missed a whole bunch of stuff with their patients because they weren't. Family planning providers can provide that either in training or in provider partnerships. And it's an essential piece of integrated care that I think has been ignored for far too long. And that's my own editorial comment. The other place where I think family planning value to primary care has been extremely undervalued in the past is in the ability to prevent pregnancy, unplanned pregnancy, in women with chronic illnesses and or mental health issues. As I looked at partnerships in a previous role of service delivery, and I would go talk with mental health and substance abuse providers about partnering with our family planning organization, they would look at me as if I had 3 heads and say, why? I said, well, okay, what happens when your dual diagnosis patient gets pregnant? I'm like, oh, they have to leave the program. It's like, okay, we can help. And they're like, oh, yeah, that makes so much sense. We never thought of it before. So it's in areas like that where I think that we can do it more quantitatively. We can certainly help in areas like some of the HEDIS measures and things that the primary care practices are being monitored on, cancer prevention, bunch of the other things that I didn't write down that are slipping my mind at the moment. There are a couple of successful models that we've worked with that actually places have managed to integrate family planning into primary care in different ways. It goes back to one of my earlier points that there's no one right model for looking at this, that we can do it in a bunch of ways. One that I've seen recently is where family planning counselors have literally been embedded into primary care teams in a hospital-based primary care network of about 10 sites. And these counselors were initially somewhat resisted by the practices. It took a huge amount of hand-holding and on-site convincing that they were important and they were free because Title X was paying for them. It took hiring the exact right people with the right personalities to become part of the primary care team. But when I did a site visit to one of the sites of this organization in Massachusetts a few months ago, and I asked them, what would happen if your counselor disappeared? They were horrified. They said, well, we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that. Our patients wouldn't understand the right methods for them. They wouldn't know how to use them. It would take so much more of our time to do this. You have to help us make sure that doesn't happen. And that, I think, is really the sign of a true success story on this. I've also seen models where an FQHC subcontracted with a planning service provider, to do on-site services within the FQHC. So in a separate part of the facility with dedicated staff, dedicated space, maintaining confidentiality that way, it was important to both parties. And they kept it as a contractual relationship, but it was easy for the patient because they had one front door and they could easily, seamlessly go back and forth, and both parties had access to the records. I've also seen them go contractually, maintaining separate facilities, but with strong contractual relationships and even, you know, taxi or car service vouchers and things like that. For organizations that are not comfortable going quite that far, two-way referral agreements and strong support systems for those referral agreements can make a big difference. The other thing that we've seen outside of primary care, I was talking to partnerships I've been exploring a few years ago, are co-location of family planning and other confidential type of services such as mental health, HIV, AIDS, and then non-confidential services but related to family issues such as WIC and community action agencies. I think that, sorry, got behind myself in my notes. The strategies that I've seen for the ones that are successful partnerships all have a certain group of common elements. And the ones that I've seen break down are missing one or more of these particular six or seven items. The first thing seems really obvious, but it is often very hard to figure out. It's knowing what your organization wants and what the potential partner wants. And it's any type of partner I'm talking about, whether it's somebody who's going to come into your site or you're going to go into theirs, however it's going to be structured. If you can't figure out how both parties are winning by this partnership, it's not going to work because the sides will feel unevenly committed to it and the leverage will be off and the communication and the trust just won't be there. The second thing that I think is equally important, if I had enough room on the lines, I would have put them both on the same level, is that champions are needed. People who really understand the importance of family planning and what it does within other parts of the service delivery structure to integrate and with the importance of integration. And they can be at any level of the organization. I've seen it at the board level and I've seen it at the front desk or mid-level. A nurse in a key organization who's got a friend at a family planning organization can be the key to getting discussion going and keeping it going. But you have to have a champion on both sides of the discussion, or again, often it will not work. The communication has to be open. You have to sign non-disclosure agreements if you're getting into something that might get, you know, confidential information about business or patients involved, so that you really feel you can talk about all the aspects of the business. And that flows right into needing to do your due diligence. You have to look at the economic records of any partner that you're dealing with. You have to look at their quality of care records. You've got to look at how they do business and show them the same for you. Because otherwise you don't know if your organizational cultures and your financial systems and everything else are going to work, or again, if they're going to be out of balance in some way. Expensive as it may be, people often try to avoid getting legal folks or accountants or regulatory consultants involved in these discussions at an early point. I'm living proof of one deal that almost fell apart at a former organization of mine because we didn't do that early enough. We all assumed that because both organizations worked with the same union that there would be no problem in doing a partnership where organization A's staff came on site in organization B and they sat next to each other, one doing family planning, one doing primary care. Well, it turned out that they were in two different sections of the union. They had different contract provisions that were in conflict, and the whole deal had to be restructured halfway through in order to deal with that. And it was a big, big lesson that I personally can't overemphasize. I think the other issue that can often just be a complete failure promoter for lack of a better term, is internal culture. And if you don't pay attention to that issue, particularly if you're bringing family planning services into a primary care organization that has not got the culture of drinking the family planning Kool-Aid, you can run into all sorts of internal resistance about this. And it's really important to address it right up front. There are lots of ways of doing that, but you can't ignore it and just hope that it's going to disappear, because it creates a lot of subtle undermining that's really, really damaging to making things work. And then finally, I'd say it's really important to identify upfront what your measures of success are going to be, whether they're big or whether they're small, and that you set yourself up to track them as you go forward. And they can be anything from numbers of new patients to numbers of retained patients. They can be number of patients who went both places, or they can be financial success. So that's it for back to my version of Dana's different slide, which includes the contact information for the Life After 40 project staff. If any of you are family planning providers who want some help in figuring out what to do, or providers of other types who want to get connected with family planning organizations to try to integrate with them. Thank you.
We're sorry that Bill Smith wasn't able to make it, but we also have some time for questions. So if you'd like to ask some questions and direct them to our speakers. Yeah.
Sorry to be the first one. Sorry, but I think it's important to address in a little more depth the elephant in the living room of the election. If you could all respond to that a little bit. Just because, you know, what is it that will stay and not stay if the conservatives win? And, you know, since there's a few words about that, I think that's on a lot of our minds.
Yeah, I think that was yours.
So I think the answer is twofold, and I'll talk about health reform generally, and then I'll talk about Family Planning Network. So the Affordable Care Act. So if you've listened to the campaigns, right, you know that President Obama signed into law the Affordable Care Act and has done a lot to make sure that it stays in place. Routinely over the last congressional cycle, the House of Representatives, which is led by the Republicans, has passed bill after bill defunding the law. First they repealed it, then they just defunded it. And they will probably continue to defund it in the next cycle, because we anticipate that Republicans will retain the House, and we anticipate that Democrats will retain the Senate. So what they do is they block what the House does. So we anticipate that the Affordable Care Act will continue to move forward under an Obama administration, and the House and the Senate will ping-pong back and forth about repealing, replacing, repealing, replacing. Status quo, essentially, on the Affordable Care Act. If Governor Romney wins the election, I think he will repeal pieces of the Affordable Care Act, primarily the requirement that folks have insurance coverage, known as the individual mandate. The funny thing about the individual mandate is it is not a progressive idea. It is sort of a conservative idea that everybody needs to buy into coverage, right? We all have to be individually responsible for our healthcare system. But I think Governor Romney will repeal it. I also think he will chop away at the Medicaid portion of the Affordable Care Act, and I'll talk a little bit about that outside of the Affordable Care Act context. He will, I think, keep lots of the consumer protections. Those are the politically happy, for lack of a better word, politically more palatable pieces of the law, right? So a ban against insurance plans, taking away your health insurance when you get sick. An interesting story about that is when I worked on the House, we had a panel of people who got sick who had their health insurance taken away when they got sick. And it's not funny, but it was consensus. I was on one of the most I was working for a member on one of the most contentious House committees, the Energy and Commerce Committee, And it was the first time in my time there that everyone agreed that that was a bad thing. So I think that that will stay in place, that you cannot have your insurance come and take your plan when you get cancer, for example, which has been known to happen in the past. I also think the other protections around pre-existing conditions, right? You can't turn people away for that. I think allowing younger individuals to stay on their parents' plans, I think all of those consumer protection things will proceed, largely because a lot of that has already happened. The preventive services stuff, particularly the contraceptive coverage requirement under the Women's Health Preventive Services benefit, will be repealed. It has been something that both House and Senate Republicans have been working on. They've been trying to do small cuts at that benefit, so allowing insurers to decide not to cover the contraceptive portion of the Women's Health Preventive Services benefit. And I think, if I recall, Governor Romney did support one of the bills that would allow insurance plans to say, no, we won't cover contraception. So I think that will probably happen. That's the Affordable Care Act. On the general family planning side, Title 10 has been, I would say, under lots of attack as of late. It started when Republicans took control of the House in 2010. They started passing bills repealing the Title 10 program, basically defunding it. I think that will happen under a Governor Romney administration. NIFRA has been having internal conversations with its members and other advocates about fighting back against those efforts, but it is kind of a new idea, the idea that you're going to completely repeal the nation's publicly supported family planning program. The one time that it happened before 2010, 50 Republicans in the House voted to put it back. So we're in a very different politically charged environment as it pertains to family planning. So I think on the contraception and the sexual and reproductive health side, we will see lots of challenges to family planning and abortion access under a Governor Romney, because I think there is some traction there with him. I think we will see it if things stay status quo, but I think President Obama has been good, not to editorialize, in trying to prevent those things from happening through Congress. Did I answer your question, Wayne?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, okay. It's
yeah, it's definitely an interesting time. Other questions?
Okay, I will. Yes.
So I've been asked to repeat the question. The question was, as I mentioned, a lot of the pieces of the Affordable Care Act have proceeded. If Governor Romney is elected and it is repealed, what will happen? Will those things go back? Some of them, yes. So, for example, several states have already taken steps to expand their Medicaid program. Oh, and I should say, make another point about Medicaid. They could essentially drop their Medicaid expansion. A lot of states have tried to drop some of their Medicaid coverage because of the tough times that they're experiencing with the recession, and the Affordable Care Act has policies in place that say, no, you cannot do that. Without the Affordable Care Act, they will be able to do that. It is possible that I will lose my no-cost-sharing birth control through my coverage. It is also possible that my transplant will say I refuse to cover it now. So, yes, there are things that will just revert back. Yes.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing too is, can that just suddenly happen on the first day?
No.
I think that that's a confusing part of it.
Yeah, and I think what we tell our members, because we get asked this a lot, is it's hard to take away things that have already happened, right? People don't like, it's like saying repeal Medicare, right? keep your hands off, government, keep your hands off my insurance, but don't take away my Medicare, right? They don't like when things get taken away. So on day one, right, January, what day, do President 20th, inauguration day, Governor Romney will not be able to just sign a bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It needs to go through a process. There will be some negotiations. The Senate needs to get involved. Right? So the Senate will probably block any repeal bills. He will probably be able to sign some executive orders that stop certain health policies from moving forward. But it will be a gradual process as to when folks will start seeing things taken away. And some things won't get taken away. Same thing with Title X, right? Congress needs to pass bills to actually defund the Title X program. That will take a while. Congress still needs to decide whether to extend the Bush tax cuts. They also need to decide what to do about the fiscal cliff with the sequester. All of that will happen sometime between November 8th and January 15th, when all of these things start to happen, take effect. So day one, January 20th, we won't see a complete reversal of everything that has been moving forward to date. I also want to make a quick note about Medicaid. Under a President Obama, Medicaid will most likely change. President Obama has been very clear that to help bring down the nation's deficit, that there must be changes made to both Medicare and Medicaid entitlement programs because they are a large amount of what we spend in the federal government. I think his changes will be very different. I think they will impact more of the providers of Medicaid. I think reimbursement rates will be a little bit lower. I think folks may have to do some more cost sharing in the Medicaid program under Governor Romney. What is the going idea is that Medicaid will be given to the states in the form of a block grant. States will get a finite amount of money. They will be able to spend that money on whichever way, however they choose. And then once that money is gone, no one will get access to the Medicaid program. Needless to say, NIFRA is not a supporter of a Medicaid block grant idea. We like the idea that if you are just broke, you get to have health insurance coverage. But under a Governor Romney, that will be a potentially different scenario. Other questions?
Thanks for letting me interrupt. This is a really important question, and the answer isn't simple. But what we do know is that we are moving down the road with primary care as the way that most folks will get their care. And it is also clear, and there's a lot of research that's come out, and we just had a great session about it a while ago, that shows that primary care providers are not ready, as you said, or prepared, or have the capabilities of providing good, high-quality sexual and reproductive health care. So that's just the truth. We're moving toward that. NIFRA is doing a great job in taking a strategic look about family planning as it has been known for 40 years, and you know, what are the next steps in this new world? And thank you for that work. It's really amazing. One of the things that's happening right now is it's called the Sexual and Reproductive Health Workforce Project. It's a joint project of a lot of organizations who represent specialties, the nurse practitioners, you know, the OBGYNs, the family practice docs, the PAs and OBGYN, the PAs in other fields. Anyway, everyone's coming together at the end of January, and this includes Institute of Medicine and some of the work they're doing. They're a part of this. Some of the big donors are part of this. Some of the government agencies are a part of this. There's a summit for 2 days at the end of January called the Sexual and Reproductive Health Workforce Summit. One of the main goals of this is to take the first step in developing common competencies that can be a part of every specialty and discipline. And that's very hard for us in our field. They've done it well in geriatrics. They've done it well in genetics. They've done a great job in the UK in their system, which, you know, is easier because they're everyone has care. But this is a huge step. We know that this needs to happen regardless of who's elected. This needs to happen, and very quickly. But it needs to happen correctly. Every one of those fields, the nurse midwives, ACNM, the nurse midwives, the any kind of group you can think of, including the donors, the foundations, the agencies, know that this needs to happen. And the problem is that there's so many different groups with so many different cultures and so many different types of providers who don't usually get along well. How do we do this quickly and in a way that is up for everyone's benefit? So I encourage you to watch for the outcomes of this summit. AHP is the secretariat. We're convening this group, but it's, you know, this is my AHP hat. We represent a lot of different groups. So this is to get an answer to your question. How can we take that step toward having some commonality on sexual and reproductive health competencies among the various disciplines and specialties? So please, I'm happy you can send me an email. We'll talk more about that process, but NIFRA's a part of it. A lot of groups are a part of this. I feel very positive this will give us some good, really amazing step up toward bringing this care to folks who need it. The title of this project, and it's been a couple years long. AHP has been funded for a while to do some background research and from some of the big donors, and although the grants were small, to do landscape work about education for providers and what the state of that is in the United States. And then we've been funded also to conduct this summit. You can contact me directly at wshields@arhp.org for more questions about this, and I can follow up all of those who signed up. I'll make sure that the part of the materials you get is a description of the summit, the date, the expected outcomes, and next steps. It's a high-level thing because it's a dance to ensure that all of us, with all of our different hats on, get along. And every one of our specialties and disciplines, we all know this, have our own culture. And they're, you know, not because we don't like each other, it's just different for cardiologists than it is for a family planning nursing assistant. I mean, it's just a huge different way of looking at the world. And some of it's really hierarchical, and some of it is just flat and direct to patients. So we have to bring those together. So what will happen, I believe, is that there'll be some new collaborations between partners that haven't worked together before. There'll be donors present, some major foundations and government agencies who will be looking for recommendations for major groups to come together and take next steps. So I think give us, you know, a year or two, we'll have some good first steps, and I think 5 to 10 years, there'll be some really good collaboration. Okay. huge part of it. Basically, if you look at the WHO competencies that the UK system established, that's what we'll be putting forward. You know, it definitely includes abortion, definitely includes it, all of the above. What it does not include, and this is because the scope is already so huge that it's almost unmanageable, but it all needs to happen, is maternal health and maternity and maternal and child health, those aspects. And we are talking, we as in the steering committee for the project, not we as in AHP, but we are talking with the ACNM and some other related groups to work together on those specific issues in parallel. So yes, it's definitely a part of it. It'll be there. Anything else on that?
Thank you.